I want to continue on in our study that we've had in the prophetic faith of our fathers. I want to just quickly highlight what we've covered thus far. The Protestant Reformation, as you know, was born of a twofold discovery based on justification by faith and then the understanding of the Antichrist, the Bible prophecy. Those two points launched forth the Great Reformation, and which was headed up, by the way, by Martin Luther. Now, Luther, when he came to the realization that a man is saved by faith and not by works, he was led to a position where, as I mentioned before, where he was being persecuted, and he couldn't quite understand why. But nonetheless, this led him to the natural studies of Daniel and Revelation. And there was his answer, that the church, he thought, was the bride of Jesus Christ, was really the bride of Antichrist. And this, of course, caused the Great Reformation. Then developed the, what is known in history as the Counter-Reformation, where the Catholic Church knew that they had to do something, and they better do it quick. And, of course, they organized the Jesuits in 1540. And then the Council of Trent was developed in 1545 to 1563. Then counter-systems of prophetic interpretation known as preterism and futurism were developed. And then fourthly, that you have the Roman Index of Forbidden Books was established. And then five, and finally, the Inquisition. And so it was during the time of the Council of Trent that they rejected Martin Luther's position of justification by faith. And this led them down the path of saying, look, salvation is found only in the church, meaning the Church of Rome. So how could the Church of Rome be the Antichrist when she is the storehouse of God's grace? And, of course, this led the Catholic Church to develop theories of prophetic interpretation in regard to their theories of Daniel Revelation. And so this is where we find ourselves now, the Catholic counter-interpretation. Now, as I mentioned, the two schools of thought, or preterism and futurism, I want to talk about preterism first in our studies and the origins of preterism. Now, there was a Jesuit priest by the name of Louis de Alcazar from 1554 to 1613. This is when he was born and died. He was a Spanish Jesuit. He's known as the father of preterism. He wrote a 900-page commentary entitled The Investigation of the Hidden Sense of the Apocalypse. It was published after his death in 1614. But I want you to listen to the basic concepts of what he believed. Now, in this commentary, he applies the New Jerusalem to the Catholic Church. In the early centuries, the Catholic Church is to wage a twofold war. And the twofold war is against the Jewish synagogue and paganism. And by the way, preterism, if you look at the word itself, just to note, just to go back just slightly, if you go back and look at the concept of preterism, pre means before. And so preterism is a concept where it's fundamentally saying that the Antichrist cannot be the Pope, can't be the Catholic Church, because the Antichrist came before the Catholic Church, before the Pope. So that's where you get the word preterism, before. So that's the whole development, the theory. But in this commentary, he believes the Catholic Church is to wage a twofold war, one against the Jewish synagogue and the other against paganism. And from Revelation 1 through 11, Louis de Alcazar taught the rejection of the Jews and the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans. And so really what you get for the first 11 chapters is you're getting really the early century of the church. So it doesn't even go beyond AD 70. And so the first 11 chapters. And then chapters Revelation 12 to 19 is the overthrow of Roman paganism, the great harlot, and the conversion of the empire to the Catholic Church. So he saw the great whore as Roman paganism, meaning the Roman Empire, and that the conversion of the empire would be eventually established by the Catholic Church. And chapter 20, he saw the final persecution by Antichrist, who he believed to be Caesar Nero, and the Day of Judgment. And again, that was the school of the – now, we're dealing with Louis de Alcazar's theory. Now, remember, there are other preterists who came later. And every time you have another generation building on a previous theory, they tend to develop and change the theory as it advances. But this is Luis de Alcázar, but it's still fundamentally the same, by the way. Preterism is always basically teaching the Antichrist is not the Pope. It's before the rise of the Catholic Church. And so that's chapter 20. Then chapters 21 and 22, he taught the triumph of the Catholic Church, meaning the New Jerusalem. And that's a breakdown of the fundamental position. And again, we'll deal with it in a little more detail. But preterism really wasn't even considered at the time it was developed to be that serious of a threat against Protestantism. Just to show you that not only did the Protestants really attack this theory because it was so easy to show how foolish it was, even those within the Jesuit community knew that this theory wouldn't hold water. Now, it's not that they came out and rejected it and condemned it, because in the final analysis, Church of Rome doesn't care what you believe, just as long as you don't believe the truth. Because if you really believe the truth, you won't be following in the footsteps of Rome. Because you're going to have to make up your mind whether you're going to follow the words of the Holy Scripture or the traditions of men. And that's what it really comes down to. But the school of preterism has never really been a serious threat, at least at the time and when it was developed. There are those here today in modern Christianity who do embrace these theories. But again, it's pretty shabby thinking, to be very honest. Then you come to the second school of thought, and that second school of thought is really the one that is a threat, or at least taken more serious in regard to prophetic understanding. And that is this origins of futurism. Now, futurism has two individuals who are responsible for its theory. I'm going to deal with both of them, but first and foremost, we're going to deal with a man by the name of Francisco Ribera, who was a Spanish Jesuit. He was from 1537 to 1591. He is considered to be the father of futurism. He is the one who developed the theory. And again, look at the word futurism, future. In other words, again, the fundamental premise is the Pope, the Catholic Church, cannot be the Antichrist, because the Antichrist will arise in the future. This was his theory. So again, and we'll talk a little bit more as go on with this theory of futurism and how it develops. But nonetheless, Francisco Ribera is the father of futurism. Now, sometime between 1585 and 1590, he published a commentary on the Book of Revelation, in which he proposed the following, listen very carefully, that the first few chapters of Revelation apply to pagan Rome in the time of the Apostle John. So the early part of the book is, applied it again, that pre-Rome period, in the time of John. And in some cases, that is true, but not in the totality of it. But nonetheless, that was his theory. Then the rest of the book refers to the future. Now listen very carefully. Covering a period of 3.5 literal years in which the Antichrist would appear and persecute the saints just prior to the second coming of Christ. So this is the core essence of his theory, that the Antichrist is a single man who would appear at the end of the world for 3.5 years, just prior to the second coming of Jesus Christ. Now, what's interesting when you start to develop or understand his theory of that is where it leads you. For example, let's take the time period. Ribera taught that the time period of the 1260 days, 42 months, times and a half, were literal time. Now, remember what we studied before, that the Protestants believe that these time periods, or this time period, I should say, and prophetic time in general, was symbolic, not literal. So a day equals a year, Ezekiel 4:6, Numbers 14:34. And so Ribera came up and he said, no, it's not, it's, you don't interpret that symbolically, you interpret that literally. And again, all of this was developed to get the finger of prophecy, meaning Daniel, Revelation, and Paul's writings in the Man of Sin, off of the papacy. And there's only two ways you can do it, and that is Antichrist must be before the rise of the Catholic Church or after. And that's the only two positions you can take. I mean, fundamentally, of course. And so this is what at least the Catholic Church taught. And so that led them to this position, at least what Ribera taught, that he taught that the Antichrist would be a single person who would appear in the future. So the time period is literal. The man of sin is not a system. It's a literal single person who would appear at the end of time. Now that Those two points are very, very critical. Now, I want to talk about someone else important in regard to the prophetic schools of interpretation and in regard to futurism. His name is Robert Bellarmine. He was a cardinal, and he's considered the co-founder of futurism. He is from 1542 to 1621. Now, he was a Jesuit teacher at Gregorian University in Rome, and he was to teach one subject. They assigned him this particular class. And the reason, by the way, he was assigned that class is because he was, and still is considered by many, to be the brightest Jesuit in terms of, you know, theorizing about Catholicism and attacking Protestantism. But his position there at Gregorian University, he was to teach what is known as controversial theology. And that was basically how to refute Protestants or Protestantism and their views of interpretation of the Bible. He took Francisco Ribera's theory of futurism and began to really sharpen it up and develop it even more so. Sometime between 1581 to 1593, or from that period, he published a work entitled The Polemic Lectures Concerning the Disputed Points of the Christian Belief Against the Heretics of this Time. And let me tell you, this book is basically the fundamental position of the lectures that he was giving. But nonetheless, he at least it was the core essence of what he was going to teach. And Bellarmine's assault was on the Protestant principle of the year-day principle. So in other words, one of the things he was going to clearly attack and try to refute was the concept of the year-day principle that Luther understood, that other Protestants understood, that when you look at the man of sin in both Daniel and Revelation, you have to understand that this time period of the 1260 is talking about a prophetic period, not a literal period, meaning interpreted literally. And so Bellarmine started to attack that position. Now, he set out in this book to assign the symbols of prophecy to the distant past or the distant future. So he took these symbols, and he knew full well what he was doing, because he had the objective was to get the hands of prophecy off of the Pope, off of the Catholic Church. This wasn't about finding the truth. This was about how do we get the people to not come to the conclusion, based on the study of the Bible, that the Catholic Church is the Antichrist. How do we do this? Well, let's develop a new system of interpretation. That's what we'll do. So preterism was born, then future was born. And Bellarmine said, look, let's take the symbolism and let's put them, again, this is basically, you have two concepts, preterism and future. Let's take all the symbols, put them in the past, or let's put them all in the future. Instead of, again, that present moment, well, the little horn, there's a symbol, for example, the little horn power of Daniel, chapter 7. Well, the little horn of Daniel 7 is the same as the composite beast of Revelation 13. It's the same as the man of sin of 2 Thessalonians. It's the same as the harlot beast of Revelation 17. It's the same as the king of the north of Daniel 11, and so forth. So all the Protestants knew and said, well, that's the Pope. That's the Catholic Church. That's the system. And Bellarmine said, no, that symbol, no, that's in the past or that's in the future. So it was, again, a means by which you diverted the attention of the people from the real objective, and that is, of course, the Catholic Church is the Antichrist. Now, and again, he believed that by eliminating the application of prophecy, to the long papal ascendancy of the Middle Ages, that if he could get you not to look at the Catholic Church as the Antichrist, then it would no longer be a system. See, in other words, the man of sin is not a system anymore. It's just a single person. And that's where he came to. And that was the point. And it's basically fundamentally the same, really, as Francisco Ribera, that the papacy or the Antichrist is a single person who would reign in the future for 3.5 years. And that was the critical moment. And he honed in these concepts and these ideas. And again, he really started to develop the theory a little further on this. Now, when the Catholics came to the issue of Antichrist, they developed it on a twofold issue, just like the Protestants. Just like the Protestants. And I want you to look at this. Now, they came to the issue of Antichrist's nature and the Antichrist's duration. Now, I've been talking about them, and I want you to listen very carefully, because I'm going to read you some statements from the Catholic Church on these issues. Now, The Catholics believed it to be a single man who would rule the world at the end of time. So again, the nature of Antichrist, a single man, right? Listen to this statement. This is taken from Prophetic Faith of Our Fathers, Volume 2, page 500. Now, this is from Robert Bellarmine. He's stressing the concept, the idea of a single man theory. Okay? He says this, quote, "For all Catholics think thus." All right, now, all Catholics think this way, that Antichrist will be one certain man. Okay? So what do all Catholics believe when they come to the approach of interpreting the little horn, the man of sin, the harlot woman? Well, it's a single person, a single man, not a system, not a succession of men, but a single person. Then he says this, quote, "But all heretics teach." Now, according to a Catholic church, anyone who disagrees with her is a heretic. He says, "But all heretics teach that Antichrist is expressly declared to be not a single person, but an individual throne," meaning a system, "an absolute kingdom, and seat, an apostate seat of those who are over the church." So here we see that Bellarmine is saying, look, we Catholics, and all Catholics think this way, that the Antichrist is a single man. Heretics, on the other hand, they reject that theory. So Bellarmine made it very clear, and the Catholic Church made it very clear, that the Antichrist is not a system. Again, what does this do? Well, it diverts the attention from the Church of Rome. It makes the Antichrist something other than the Catholic Church. So why are you looking at the Catholic Church? You should be looking somewhere else. That's what the Catholic Church was hoping. Then we come to the second point, and that's the duration of Antichrist. And again, the Catholics were teaching fundamental issue. The Antichrist would reign for 3.5 literal years at the end of the world. Again, that futurism, that's the concept of the futurist position. Let me read to you a couple of statements here from the Catholics on this position. This first statement, by the way, is taken from Prophetic Faith of Our Fathers, Volume 2, page 502. This, again, is Robert Bellarmine, and he's dealing with the duration of Antichrist. And he says this, quote, "The fifth argument is taken from the duration of Antichrist. Antichrist will not reign except for 3.5 years. But the Pope has now reigned spiritually in the Church more than 1,500 years. Now, you can see immediately, I mean, it's so incredible what they're thinking, or at least their attempts to try to interpret the Scriptures. And the whole objective is to say, look, the Pope's not the Antichrist. I mean, he said, look, the Antichrist will reign for 3.5 years. Literal years. That's all. It's just 3.5 years. So how could the Pope possibly reign or be the Antichrist, because he's been reigning for now, well, more than 1,500 years. Now, of course, when they say 1,500 years, they mean from the time of Peter being the first Pope, according to the Catholic Church. Peter was the first Pope, which, by the way, biblically, that is absolute a farce. Peter was not the first pope. Believe me, Peter, if he were alive today, would no more join the Catholic Church than a pig is clean to eat. But nonetheless, Bellarmine was teaching the Catholic Church that the Pope is not the Antichrist, because, again, they base it on this 3.5 years. But look what it goes on to say. "Nor can anyone be pointed out who has been accepted for Antichrist, who has ruled exactly 3.5 years. And again, here they're sticking very close to this issue. Antichrist can only reign for 3.5 years. That's it. So who can you even find that will fit that characteristic, that identifying mark? Well, it can't be the Pope. He's reigned for more than 1,500 years. And we don't find anybody at this stage who can fit that period of time. Now watch what he says. Therefore, because of this, the Pope is not the Antichrist, that Antichrist has not yet come. In other words, the critical issue for Bellarmine was to say the Antichrist is not at this present moment, meaning the Pope. It has to arise in the future. And he's basing this all on the duration of the Antichrist. Well, two things, nature and the duration, but this argument here is based on the duration. Now, I'm going to read you another statement. This is taken from Prophetic Faith of Our Fathers, Volume 2, page 492. And this is Francisco Ribeiro's position on the 1260 days of the two witnesses of Revelation 11. And again, we're dealing with the duration. We're dealing with the very specific nature in which you interpret these things. And this is what the Jesuits were teaching. This is what Bellarmine and Francisco Ribeiro. And listen very carefully now. This 1260 days of Revelation chapter 11, how he interprets this. He says, and they, meaning the two witnesses, shall prophesy for 1268 days. The time of the prophesying of the two prophets is not counted by years. Okay, so you can't take that 1260 days and make it years. He says, nor by months, since they are not to be whole years or months. And therefore it remained that it should be computed by days. And so what did Francisco Ribeiro teach in regard to the 1260? Well, it's exactly the same issue as Robert Bellarmine. And that is the 1260 days are literal, not symbolic. And once they came to this point, then again, friends, you find yourself in a position where they began to really, really see their theory developed. And this school of futurism, again, it wasn't that the Protestants couldn't deal with these issues. They dealt with them in a very firm and I believe to be a very intelligent manner. It wasn't really till later you get into the 19th century, people like Margaret MacDonald, Edward Irving, and C.I. Schofield, you know, these type of people came, and they're the ones through it's Plymouth Brethren, really, who developed the theory of what is known as modern futurism. And modern futurism is basically built on the futuristic school of Ribeiro and Bellarmine. And so, in other words, really what you're getting today in C.I. Schofield, for example, in his notes, which is probably the most famous futurist, modern futurist theory of interpretation of Daniel Revelation, it's built on Jesuit school of interpretation. The whole purpose was to make sure that the Catholic Church get the finger of prophecy off itself and put it on someone else. And really, remember what I said before, that the whole concept of the Reformation, or excuse me, the Counter-Reformation, was to destroy Protestantism. This is the whole purpose. And what's so sad today is to see how many are caught up in the modern theory of prophetic interpretation that is developed by the Jesuits that have infiltrated Christianity. And what's sad is that there are even those within the Adventist community who have started to imbibe the theories, at least some concepts of futurism, and mingle it in with the historical school of prophetic interpretation. But nonetheless, this is really the theory of the of futurism in this. Now, I want to deal with an issue at which I've entitled, it says, which school do you belong, do you attend? And I want to deal now, going back a little bit here, on the roots of historicism. And I want to just to spend some time on this, just for a moment or two. Now, because when we look at futurism and preterism and contrasting that with historicism, you've got to ask yourself, really, where do you stand? Now, let me explain something. You cannot mingle good with evil and think that the end result will be good. Regardless of the ratio of the percentage of the two, it's irrelevant. Whether it's even 0.1% of error mingled in with the good, it's still error. You don't have truth. Truth can only be truth when it's 100% the truth. So we need to analyze not only the theories of the schools of prophetic interpretation, but we also in the process need to analyze our own understanding. And one of the reasons, again, I stress this is because I don't want to see people fall into the trap of embracing false theories of prophetic interpretation, all the while thinking that what they're introducing is a new light or understanding of how we approach our interpretation of prophecy. Friends, you're either a historicist, which is the Protestant school of thinking, or you're a futurist or a preterist. And those two, last two that I mentioned, really are from the Catholic school. For really, let's put it down there. You're either a Protestant in your thinking, or you're a Catholic in your thinking when it comes to prophetic schools of interpretation. And that's as simple as that. And you can't mingle the two theories. There has to be a constant agreement, one or the other. So here's the thing. Let's talk about the roots of future or historicism. Now, historicism, the basic premise of the structure of the nature of prophecy is symbolic. Now, they base this, if you go back in Revelation, in the book of Revelation, chapter 1, and you look at verse 1, I'm going to read to you this verse here. It says this, it says, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him, to show unto his servants the things which must shortly come to pass, and he sent and signified it, meaning the revelation, by his angel, which who is Gabriel, unto his servant John. So I want you to notice the concept of the revelation. First of all, it went from God the Father to Jesus Christ, then Jesus Christ to Gabriel, then Gabriel to John, then John to us, right? Now, so that's the basic order. But now, the revelation, when it came from God and went to Jesus, I want you to notice nothing changed in the nature of the revelation of that vision, all right? Nothing changed in terms of the way it was communicated. Now, when it went from Jesus to Gabriel, then it changed. Because when it went from Jesus to Gabriel, the Bible says it was signified. And that word signify means signified, or put into signs and symbols. So the basic nature, the structure of prophecy, is highly symbolic. Not to say that everything is symbolic, but that you must understand that the framework in which prophecy is given in signs and symbols. So it's how you interpret those symbols and the application in which you then apply those symbols to determine the nature of the interpretation. And so the Protestants understood that the basic framework of prophecy is highly symbolic. They knew that. They then came to the conclusion when looking at the prophecies and understanding how it was to be fulfilled, they understood that history is the key to unlock the mystery of the understanding of prophecy. In other words, they saw history and prophecy going hand in hand. And this is why you get the school, the Protestant school of prophetic interpretation known as historicism. It's history. History is a vital part. I mean, they saw this in a very simple or an easy way. Now, look, I'll tell you what we're going to do. I'm going to take the first part. We're going to look at the basic structure of prophecy in regard to the nature of the Protestant position of the roots of historicism. So it's built on two things. The views of the basic structure of prophecy is symbolic. The second is the history is the fulfillment of prophecy. So let's take the first one. Historicism, the nature of prophecy is highly symbolic. Now, again, it doesn't deny the literal aspects of prophecy, but it understands that the context of the passage will determine whether you interpret the passage or phrase or word number, literal or symbolic. Now, that's the critical key. Protestantism knew that since the book of Revelation, Daniel, and other parts of prophecies, or prophetic books, when you come to a framework of prophecy, they knew it was highly symbolic. That doesn't mean everything is symbolic, but the context and the way in which the word, the phrase, the number that's made, or you have to use that to determine whether it's going to be taken literal or symbolic. So all of these things come into play. So in other words, context, that's the critical moment of understanding. Now, as I said, I gave you a very interesting statement of Revelation 1:1. Revelation was signified. Remember, it was signified. So that's the basic structure of it. Let me read you a statement from the pen of inspiration. This is taken from Bible Commentary, Volume 1, page 1106. By the way, just as a reference, I would recommend that you look at Prophets and Kings, page 485. I'm not going to read it to you, but I just want to give it to you there just as a reference point. But let me read to you the statement from Bible Commentary, volume 1, page 1106. This is what the servant Lord says. Listen very carefully. God himself employed pictures and symbols to represent to his prophets lessons which he would have them give to the people, and which could thus be better understood than if given in any other way. He appealed to the understanding through the sense of sight. Prophetic history was presented to Daniel and John in symbols, and these were to be presented, and these were represented plainly upon tables that he who read might understand. So, why did God put the Bible of the books of Daniel, Revelation in symbols and other prophecies in symbolic nature? Why? Well, it was to appeal to our understanding, our sense of sight. He knew this would create a great interest. Who is this beast? Got seven heads, 10 horns, a body of a leopard, the feet of the bear, the mouth of a lion. I mean, a little horn comes out among the 10 horns. And you can go down the list, the great red dragon of Revelation 12, the woman riding the beast of Revelation 17. These are fascinating symbols that are immediately appeal to the sense of sight, which would create curiosity. I want to know, what does that mean? And so this is the reason why God put it into signs and symbols, at least one of the major reasons why he put it into signs and symbols. And so this is really critical to the understanding the school of prophetic interpretation from the historicist position. Now, the second position I want to talk about is the fulfillment of the historicist view of history as the fulfillment of prophecy. Now, this is very critical. Protestants believed, and the true Protestants even today believe, prophecy is history written in advance. Listen very carefully. That prophecy is simply history written in advance. That history is reflecting what prophecy predicted. Now, I want to read to you some statements. All right? Listen very carefully. This is from Eight Testimonies, page 307. There is a study of history that is not to be condemned. Sacred history was one of the studies in the schools of the prophets. We are to see in history the fulfillment of prophecy. Now, dear friends, that statement says it all. That history and prophecy coexist. That the nature of the prophetic school of interpretation of Protestants is historical, and therefore we become, as the word says, historicists. Let me read you another statement. This is taken from a Protestant by the name of the Reverend John Cumming. This is from his book entitled God in History and Science, page 57. He says, prophecy is history undeveloped. And history is prophecy in full manifestation. And it is by the light struck out in the transition of the one into the other that we see God clearly. Hear, hear. I mean to tell you, that's a great statement. So, prophecy is history undeveloped. And history is prophecy in full manifestation. And what happens? We see God more clearly. When we understand Bible prophecy and the fulfillment of Bible prophecy, we see God as he is. A loving God, a compassionate God, a merciful God, a God who cares for us. And finally, the last statement I want to read to you is taken from Prophetic Faith of Our Fathers, Volume 2, page 272. This is actually from Martin Luther. I want you to listen to what he said. And I love this statement. As formally stated, prophecies can only be perfectly understood after they have been fulfilled. End of quote. That was what Martin Luther said, and I couldn't agree more with Mr. Martin Luther. Because what is Martin Luther saying? Friends, if you really want to understand the accuracy of prophecy, then you got to look to history. History and prophecy go hand in hand. Now, what does that say about unfulfilled prophecy? Well, it says we need to be cautious. You know, don't run ahead of the understanding. Don't your impatience interpret something that really the prophet never meant. So we need to be careful. Don't rush ahead. Don't give a foolish understanding in regard to the nature of interpretation of prophecy. But I will say this, is Luther said, and the Protestants believed, and as I say, even today, those who understand this know that history and prophecy walk hand in hand. And it's very critical that we come to this. So this is really the roots of historicism. It comes down to two basic principles, that the basic structure of prophecy is symbolic, and that we need to understand that basic framework, and that history is the fulfillment of prophecy. They coincide with each other. Okay? But now let's talk about the roots of futurism. Okay? So let's do it. There's two basic views or concepts or principles that is built on, the very core essence. What is futurism? Now listen, futurists are literalists when it comes to their understanding of the structure or nature of prophecy. Now this is very important that we see this. Futurists are literalists in the fundamental approach of how they interpret prophecy. And number two, Futurism rejects the historicist view of the fulfillment of prophecy. In other words, it makes a future application of fulfilled historical prophecy. And then futurists are then forced to reinterpret the passage. In other words, when they reject a fulfillment of prophecy, so something that's already been fulfilled, they reject it because of the basic fundamental of history and prophecy going hand in hand. Once they reject that, they are forced then to make a future application of this prophecy, or this is again dealing with futurism now, a future application, and you have to naturally do what? You've got to reinterpret it. In other words, you've got to put a new interpretation upon this. All right? So let's deal with the first one here. We're going to deal with the futurists are literalists when it comes to the nature of understanding of prophecy. And now, what are we talking about when we say literalism in regard to the approach to interpreting the scripture or the prophecy? What it really means is this, that the futurists will look at a symbol, and instead of interpreting that symbol as the way God intended it to be, a symbolic representation of something, they interpret it literally. So literalism takes the place of symbolism. I'm going to read to you some statements, and I want you to listen to these statements in regard to this. The first statement I want to read to you is from a book by the titled Prophecy in the Church, page 193, by Oswald Allis. Now, it's dealing with the subject of dispensationalism. Now, dispensationalism is nothing more than a branch that's an offshoot of futurism. Okay? It's fundamentally the same. I'm going to read to you this. Dispensationalists are literalists. And being literalists, they must be futurists in the interpretation of prophecy. Now, Oswald Allis understood this very clearly, that if you are a literalist in your approach to prophecy, you are a futurist. The fundamental school of futurism is literalism taking the place of symbolism. So this is what Oswald Allis believes, and he's absolutely correct. Let me read you another statement. This is taken from Prophecy and Prediction, page 166 and 167 by Dewey Beagle. And listen to what he says about this. Again, dealing with dispensationalism, and dispensationalists are nothing more than futurists. It's just an offshoot branch of futurism. Again, as I told you before, there are many other schools of thought that come from futurism and preterism. But this is what a dispensationalist, listen to this, dispensationalists, meaning futurists, have claimed to take the Bible literally. The crucial factor in interpretation is to know when to take the passage literal and when spiritually. The clues should come from the passages being studied. But because of the dispensationalist absolute view of prophecy, they determine ahead of time that all prophecies will be interpreted literally. In other words, their assumption has already determined the outcome, no matter what the passage says. End of quote. And that is precisely the danger. That is precisely the problem with literalist view of prophetic interpretation, which comes from futurism. So when you start with the premise of literalism in the place of symbolism, you've already predetermined ahead of time how you're going to interpret that, regardless of what the passage says, regardless of what all the other identifying aspects may be in regard to that particular point. You have already determined the outcome. That's the danger. And then finally, this is another statement coming from Daniel Fuller, and it's entitled, from the book entitled The Hermeneutics of Dispensationalism, page 386. He says, therefore, such a system, meaning dispensationalism, futurism, which is both internally inconsistent and unable to harmonize itself with the biblical data, must be based on a faulty hermeneutical basis. Hear, hear, Mr. Fuller. You see, Daniel Fuller realized, like Oswald, Alice, and others, they realized that when you approach beforehand the study of the Bible, particularly prophecy, and you say, well, it's already literal, not taking into consideration the context, then you predetermine the outcome. And in so doing, that fundamental approach, dear friends, is built on a faulty hermeneutic. Now, that's a fancy word, just means, I don't know why sometimes these words are brought out by theologians. I guess it must make them feel good, but, you know, faulty approach to study, all right, how you study the Bible, principles of, you know, your approach to study. And so it's a faulty way of studying the Bible, okay? And so this is the problem. This is the problem. So futurists are literalists, and they predetermine ahead of time how they're going to interpret the passage. So anytime something is symbolic and you take it literally, listen very carefully, you are embracing the futurist theory of prophetic interpretation. Now, let's talk about the second. Literalism in the place of, oh, this is, by the way, just to give you some examples, by the way, I take back just a little bit. Literalism in the place of symbolism. These are just a few examples, and there's just a few now. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but this is just a few points I want to make. Some of the points where they, futurists, interpret symbolism as literal. For example, Daniel 7:25, where it says the time, times, and a half, and the dividing of time. There they take that and say, well, that's not 1,260 years, that's 3.5 years at the end of time. So that's one thing that they do. Daniel 8:14, the 2,300 days. People take the word days in the evening and the morning, and then they say, well, that's only half the time. And or, you know, it's amazing how many different views they take the Daniel 8:14. So it's not real years. It's not 2,300 years. It's 2,300 days, literal days. You know, and again, the symbolism in prophecy. You look, for example, at Daniel chapter 11. This is another fascinating portion here in Daniel 11, particularly when you start to look at verse 40. Make sure I get it right here. Verse 41, talking about the king of the north. He says, and he shall enter into the glorious land, and many shall be overthrown. And, of course, they take the glorious land instead of understanding it to represent the church. And that you'll find, by the way, in Malachi chapter 3, that the glorious land is the church. You'll find that, and I believe it's verse 17, if my memory is right. But in Malachi, but here in Daniel chapter 11, in verse 41, he talks about the glorious land. The glorious land is representing the church, and there are those who then reinterpret that and say, well, no, it doesn't mean that at all, and they take it literal. And in other words, it has to be a literal nation, which is insane theory, because that is a violation of the historicist school of prophetic interpretation. I don't have time to get involved in all this, but nonetheless, it's built on the fundamental principle of the transferring of the covenants. But nonetheless, you find here, time and time again, a violation of the principle of prophetic at the school of interpretation with the roots of futurism, literalism in the place of symbolism. And again, you can go to Daniel chapter 12, verse 7, 11, and 12, where it talks about 1260, 1290, 1335, a reinterpretation, launching them out in the future, making them literal days at the end of time. It's just, it's absolute, well, it's just insane. It's just insane. You can't take a symbol employed in Bible prophecy and then make it literal and think you're on solid ground when it comes to interpreting what that means. This is the Jesuit school of thinking. And the reason being is because they don't want the truth to get out. So literalism in the place of symbolism. Then we come to the second point I want to bring out. And the second point is futurism rejects the historicist view of the fulfillment of prophecy. Now, once they reject a prophecy that's already been fulfilled, all right, so they take a historical prophecy that the Protestants teach and say, that no, that wasn't fulfilled. Now, that means two things. They have to make that, they make a future application of the fulfilled prophecy, and then they are forced to reinterpret the passage. So, in other words, they've got to take something that's already been fulfilled. Once they reject it, they then have to take that prophecy and put it in the future. And number two, they've got to put a new application to it, a reinterpretation. All right? I want to read to you a statement. This is from, again, Prophecy in the Church, page 192 by Oswald Allis. I want you to listen to what he says in regard to this. Dispensationalists are literalists. And being literalists, and again, dispensational is futurism. Dispensationalists are literalists, and being literalists, they must be futurists in the interpretation of prophecy. Consequently, they must hold that there are a number of predicted events, many of which interpreters of the historical school believe to have already taken place, that must occur before the coming of the Lord in glory. So in other words, what he's saying is that once you become a literalist, literalism in the place of symbolism, you're going to have to take historical fulfilled prophecy, reinterpret that, and put it in the future. In other words, you're denying the historicist school of prophetic interpretation. And that's precisely what the Jesuits have done. And for example, I'll give you a couple examples. Let's take, and this is, I'm giving ones that are very easy to understand, comprehend. The little horn of Daniel 7 is found in verse 8, 11, 20, 21, 24, 25. All right, there's all the verses in Daniel 7 talking about the little horn. So the historicist comes. He realizes that the fundamental structure of prophecy is symbolic. He knows that context alone determines whether you take something symbolic or literal. So he's going to look for all the characteristics and identifying marks before he rushes to judgment and decipher what is being said there. So he comes to Daniel 7, and he looks at all these verses. He comes to the little horn, and he says, context of the way in which that description is being given in regard to this power can only be understood symbolically. So the little horn can't be literal. It's symbolic, and it represents not a single person, but a system. And so the historicist comes to that approach. Well, what does a futurist do? He says, No. It's, remember, he's predetermined ahead of time because he's a literalist, literalism in the place of symbolism. And what does he do? He says, no, this is not a symbol. It's not one man. It's not one system or a system. It's a single person. So he reinterprets the concept. And you go ahead with the 1260, 1290, 1335. It's not symbolic. They're literal days. And one of the greatest reinterpretations, or at least the futurist school in regard to reinterpreting, you think, for example, the 70 weeks. And you look at the 70th week. We're talking about the midst of the week he shall be cut off, referring to Jesus Christ. And the futurists, and now again, this is where you have a development of futurism through the modern era, which was back in the 19th century, which is considered modern futurism by Margaret MacDonald, Edward Irving, John Nelson Darby, and C.I. Schofield. And you look at these theories and you see what they developed, and they, of course, created the theory and continued on, the school of literalism and the place of symbolism, and thus rejecting the historical school and putting things in the future with a reinterpretation. They did that with the 70 weeks of Daniel chapter 9. And it's amazing to me, when one studies the 70 weeks of Daniel 9, how anyone could possibly miss the significance and the beauty of this prophecy. Friends, this is the most, my opinion, I think it's the most beautiful prophecy in all the Bible, referring to the coming of the Holy Messiah, the Christ, that he would give his life on behalf of mankind. This is the, it not only tells us when he would come, but the very year, the time when he would be crucified. I mean, it's incredible. The prophecy is magnificent. And yet what happens in the school of futurism, when you take literalism in the place of symbolism and you then reject the historical fulfillment, you naturally have to then reinterpret it and put it in the future. And that's what people have done. It's called the gap theory. And that's insane. It's just absolutely insane. But, you know, these are some of the things that are being brought about. And what, and again, friends, what is bothering me on this is that today we're getting people caught up, you know, with this whole way of thinking in regard to the understanding of prophecy. And look, I go back to what I said to you before in regard to our introduction. You remember when Jesus said, "Not one stone shall be left upon another." Then the disciples came to tell us, "When shall these things be? What shall be the sign of thy coming and the end of the world?" Four times, what did Jesus say? What did he say? He said, "Beware, lest anybody deceives you." And this nature of the deception, it's coming from within the Christianity. In other words, we have more to fear from within than we do from without. And this is the danger. And people don't realize how important it is to be faithful to Jesus Christ and to maintain a firm hold of the truth. We're living in awesome times, there's no doubt about it, but we're living in dangerous times as well. We need to watch and pray, watch and pray. Hold on to the truth. Because, my friends, I can tell you this right now. We've got a great work to do. And so I want to encourage you. Remain faithful. Be determined to hold on to the Lord. And this can only be done, of course, when we, I think, honestly look within our own hearts and realize what's really taking place in our personal lives. And I pray that God will bless you and the Lord will keep watch over you. I want to encourage you, friends, to put away your sins, make things right between God and your fellow man. And I know sometimes it's a challenge. Believe me, I can tell you. But I just hope and pray that you will find the very grace that you need, because I know God will do it for you. I know he'll help you to overcome both hereditary and cultivated tendencies to sin. And I know God will give us the victory. So keep your eyes on the Lord. Remember the words of Jesus, "Take heed that no man deceive you." And may God bless you, and the Lord be with you, is my prayer.